Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking with Dr. Dana Gorzolani-Mostak about her book titled Tracks on the Trail, Popular Music, Race, and the US Presidency, published by the University of Michigan Press, which does the really interesting work I found of analyzing what sorts of music gets played by US presidential candidates when they are trying to convince people to vote for them? And what sorts of meanings are they trying to make happen with those musical choices? Might audiences be perceiving about those musical choices? And sort of how those two things mix together. So obviously, this is a kind of perennially relevant question, but particularly in an American presidential election year. So Dana, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast to tell us about your book.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm honored to be here today.
Well, we're very pleased to have you. And could you start us off, please, by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Sure. So I'm an associate professor of music at Georgia College and State University, a public liberal arts college in Milledgeville, Georgia. I'm a musicologist by training. I teach courses on music and conflict, global musics, American music, and I even direct a few of the music ensembles here. So my book is titled Tracks on the Trail, Popular Music, Race, and the U.S. Presidency. So why did I decide to write it? Okay, that's a bit of a tough one. I'll maybe begin by saying that we live in an age where political communication takes on many forms. While pundits and journalists, politicians, voters, I think they do tend to privilege the spoken word or images, but, music can be just as powerful of a persuader. So I wrote the book because I wanted to explore the phenomenon of music and temporary campaigns from a musicological perspective. I also wanted to engage a broader audience with this topic. In the book, I try to avoid too much discipline-specific jargon in hopes that this work will be accessible to all folks out there that have an interest in learning more about music and American politics.
What a lovely introduction. Thank you for telling us a bit about how you came to the book. Can you tell us more about the questions that the book is investigating and how you developed them?
Sure. So in the introduction of the book, I make the point that, the presidency is very much a symbol and an index of American masculinity, and really by extension, whiteness. So kind of the question for me was, I think candidates use music to signal identities outside of this, sort of quotes here, standard. So the question kind of became, how do presidential candidates harness racialized sounds to assert authority, identity, affiliation, and cultural competence? And additionally, what value might these articulations of race offer both the candidates and the voters that they wish to reach? I also explore a third question. Conversations about official campaign music, and when I say official, I mean things such as walk-on songs or a playlist a candidate themselves tweets out on social media or music at a fundraiser. Typically this type of musical activity makes the news cycle, but I really wanted to expand the conversation to incorporate what I call unofficial campaign music. And that really is music that is user-generated and circulated on social media. And this could come in the form of, remixes, a newly composed song, a parody of a pre-existing song. So sort of the third question became, you know, why do voters choose to engage with the candidates through the production of music? And, you know, how have digital formats and all these wonderful technologies of interactivity, how have they cultivated new modes of political engagement?
Okay, so those are some very interesting questions that I think do what you said at the beginning of speaking to a variety of audiences. If we go then into how you've answered the questions, why do you start the book discussing how Bill Clinton capitalized on racialized sounds in his campaign?
So, you know, let me just begin by saying, you know, music on the campaign trail is by no means a new phenomenon. But, you know, Bill Clinton was, you know, one of the first 20th century candidates to use it in a particularly effective way. Rewind to June 1992, Clinton played Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel on his saxophone on the Arsenio Hall show. You know, and I think this performance and Clinton's broader music strategy, you know, really represent a crucial moment in the formation of Clinton's presidential identity and his successful bid. But, you know, they also serve as a referential snapshot in the history of music on the trail. And what I mean by that is, you know, when a lot of people in the present have conversations about music and the trail, they often refer back to Bill Clinton in this particular moment on the Arsenio Hall show and his use of Fleetwood Mac's song, Don't Stop. So it's kind of an important point that a lot of folks have looked back to. You know, that being said, you know, Clinton was not the first presidential candidate to deploy racialized sounds in forging his presidential identity either. However, you know, he really was the first baby boomer candidate and the first candidate, you know, deeply imbricated in the trappings of popular culture. So, you know, for these reasons, he seemed like a logical starting point, you know, for a study examining the intersection of race and music on the campaign trail.
Certainly investigating any question and having kind of people keep referring to a particular incident always sort of perks any researcher's ears
right?
off of like, hang on, there's something happening here.
Yes.
All right. So let's stay looking at these candidates and figuring out kind of what signaling is going on here. Can we talk about Obama as a candidate? How was he using music to project, you talk about in the book, an identity that was both real and respectable, given the kind of balance he had to create between his background as a presidential candidate and obviously as a Black leader, which isn't something that had necessarily been seen to that level before?
You know, Obama generated a lot of excitement with this speech he gave at the Democratic National Convention in 2004. But, you know, as he, you know, began to consider, you know, a presidential run, you know, there really were some distinct hurdles that he faced. You know, he was born in Honolulu. He spent a lot of his early years living abroad. You know, he was the multiracial son of a Black father. His relatives hail from Kenya, Kansas, and Indonesia. You know, and while a good number of Black political leaders got their start in the church, you know, Obama didn't really make a declaration of faith until he reached adulthood. He was also younger than the typical presidential candidate. He was, I believe, 45 when he announced his candidacy. And, you know, he didn't come from a muddied background either. So he had these unique challenges. And sort of the case I make in the book is that one of the ways Obama negotiated his multiracial identity was through the medium of sound. So what do I mean by that? Well, you know, as a Black candidate aiming to connect with young first-time voters, he needed to engage with hip-hop in a compelling and in a meaningful way. You know, however, that kind of engagement also posed a potential challenge for him as well, as, you know, clearly he was seeking support from older Black voters and also women voters as well. So, you know, what I discuss in the book is how he navigated this challenge. So on the one hand, he very much embraced certain aspects of hip-hop culture, the creativity, the energy, the entrepreneurship. But at the same time, he made sure to, you know, take a stance where he still did not shy away from openly critiquing some other aspects of hip-hop culture as well. And this is something that came up in several of the interviews that he did over the course of the 2008 campaign. You know, in one interview he did for BET, and this was in 2008, you know, on the one hand, he criticized some of the messaging in rap, but he also applauded its artistry as well. He also took the time to sort of drop some of the sort of vernacular language associated with hip hop. He praised the artists for being entrepreneurs, right? But at the same time, you know, this positioning he took, he was very cautious about it as well. You know, in a lot of ways, he kind of established himself as kind of this sort of cool dad figure of hip hop. You know, he positioned himself as a very discerning admirer, but not as an insider. You know, in these sort of connections he made with hip hop, it wasn't just, you know, in these interviews either. You know, there's also sort of this nonverbal language he developed as well. You know, there's sort of this one instance where this was, you know, still during the primary campaign, and, you know, he had been subjected to some attacks by his opponent, Hillary Clinton, in a news debate, you know, the night before. And, you know, in this speech he gave the next day, he, you know, sort of acknowledged these criticisms of Hillary Clinton. And then he took his hand and he pretended to brush dirt off his shoulders. And in doing so, he, you know, was alluding to a very popular 2003 track by Jay-Z called Dirt Off Your Shoulder. You know, and this song is kind of an example of, you know, how to confront hostility in a non-aggressive manner. You know, and people point to this instance of Obama brushing the dirt off his shoulders is a really good example of Obama's ability to code switch, right? And sort of making this gesture, he's signaling to hip hop audiences, you know, that, you know, I'm communicating with you in a language you understand. I'm putting forward a positive message. You know, when one is in the field of politics, they could take the higher ground, just as one might do if they're out, you know, walking on the street. So, you know, really in kind of appropriating this gesture, you know, he's, you know, kind of embracing the respectable side of street culture, but he's at the same time remaining removed from kind of the language of the song as well. So this is just kind of one example, you know, where he's demonstrating his knowledge and appreciation for hip hop, but also kind of maintaining that distance. And, you know, he did that not just through his language, but also through his playlists as well. You know, if you went to an Obama rally in 2008, you would have heard Stevie Wonder, Jackie Wilson, Aretha Franklin, Earth, Wind, and Fire. So all these musicians that, you know, were really super popular in the 1960s and the 1970s. So by, you know, aligning himself as sort of being a fan with this older music, he's also kind of establishing this generational distance from hip hop as well. But I think, you know, there's another reason why this soundtrack was effective for Obama. You know, in sort of the narrative surrounding his campaign, you know, he very much established, you know, his own sort of personal connection with the civil rights movement. And, you know, he kind of needed to do that because he didn't really share the same background or the same struggles as, you know, as a lot of the Black leaders that paved the way for his success, really. So in sort of choosing this soundtrack that, you know, would have been popular during and right after the civil rights movement, sort of became a way of communicating with these older voters that, you know, he may not have shared the same struggles, but, you know, he shares the same goals, the same dreams, if you will. And it's kind of the last thing I'll mention about that is, you know, usually presidential candidates are very much focused on, you know, the virtues of strength and charisma. But, you know, Obama, you know, really humanized himself by focusing on intimate relationships, relationships with his family. And if you think of the songs that he used on the trail by artists like Stevie Wonder, Sign, Seal, Deliver, I'm Yours, or Jackie Wilson, Higher and Higher, you know, these songs are about love. They're about romantic love. They're smooth. They're sentimental. And they really sort of put forward this ethos of nurturing and caring and responsiveness. And I think that's something that, you know, certainly appealed to this large group of female voters who kind of had their own crushes on Obama, so to speak. So, you know, really that's what I mean when I talk about him striking this balance between you know, being real as that is defined in hip hop culture, but also respectable through the lens of this music that has these close associations, you know, with you know, romantic relationships, but also with the civil rights movement as well.
A very tricky balance to strike.
Yes.
With all those different threads, and not one that they can all do, right? So we've so far mentioned two candidates who do successfully become president, Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. But you also talk about ones that didn't quite make it. So let's talk about Ben Carson. What was he trying to do with music in his presidential campaign? And why didn't it work? How does this better kind of help us understand, almost in some ways comparing it to Obama, right? How can we understand, in some ways, Ben Carson was trying to do something very similar. It didn't work. Why not?
So, you know, I'll begin by saying, you know, Ben Carson had some misfires early on. And, you know, one that some folks might remember reading about, this was in November 2015. His campaign team released a radio ad, and that radio ad was titled Freedom, and it aired for a few weeks in several urban markets across the country. And, you know, in a way, Carson is kind of embracing the formula that was very successful in the Obama 2008 campaign. You might remember the video, Yes, We Can, in that this ad pairs sound bites from a Carson speech, and it pairs them with some verses rapped by a Republican Christian rapper. You know, and clearly Carson, you know, created this ad because he wanted to appeal to youth by adopting their musical vernacular. But, you know, journalists and especially folks on Twitter, now X, of course, were quick to criticize this ad. Why did they criticize it? Well, it sort of has low production value. It's trying to evoke this sort of old school style of rap. It's got this really sort of upbeat loop that's it's like a flute playing. But then, you know, Ben Carson, you know, the speeches kind of have a, I don't know, almost a monotone sort of quality to them. So really artistically, and the ad certainly leaves something to be desired. But, you know, the bigger issue here was, you know, folks criticized the ad for, you know, trying to pander to the Black community, for being condescending in a way as well. You know, I think, you know, the bigger issue here is, you know, candidates have to strike a balance with developing a music strategy. You know, on the one hand, you know, you want the music to, in some meaningful way, authentically articulate something about the candidate, their biography, their values, and their vision. But at the same time, you know, you need to acknowledge the taste disposition of the target constituency. And I think in the case of Carson, I think he understood who he was trying to target, but the music didn't accurately reflect who he was. You know, just months before this ad was released, you know, Carson had denounced hip hop culture and sort of argued that it was, you know, bringing destruction to Black communities, right? So, yeah. So, I mean, while hip hop, you know, might have been the taste of some of the voters he was trying to attract, you know, it wasn't believably his music. You know, I think authenticity is important to voters. So it's not really surprising that, you know, contrived music tastes are sometimes, you know, met with hostility on the part of people online.
All right. Well, that was really helpful to unpick kind of, in some ways, what Ben Carson did specifically, but also that wider point you're making about, like, don't come across as fake. That's not going to go well, no matter who you are. Can we talk then about an attempt to kind of use music to transform an image? And maybe this example sort of falls in the middle of Ben Carson and Obama. What was Kamala Harris doing with music to maybe move on from being the, quote, top cop? And was she successful?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Was she successful? I think it depends on who you asked. But, you know, what you say is right. You know, one of the biggest challenges she faced was, you know, on the one hand, she had this you know, sort of previous image, you know, she's a prosecutor, district attorney. So on the one hand, she was, you know, known as being, you know, kind of hard-nosed in a way. She was known as kind of being a top cop. But, you know, in the age of Black Lives Matter, you know, that identity wasn't going to work very well for her, you know, as she moved into her presidential campaign. So, you know, what she really needed to do was sort of play up, you know, her successes when she was in the Senate, you know, where she very much cultivated this identity as being a progressive reformer, if you will. And, you know, one of the things I talk about in my book is she really, from the outset of her campaign, tried to do this through cultivating a music strategy that would allow her to sort of facilitate this transformation in her image. And one of the ways she did that, and this was about a week before she formally entered the race, she participated in a segment on the Stephen Colbert Show. And this segment is called the Mood Mix. And in the Mood Mix segment, guests basically talk about their music tastes, if you will. And then they also could provide a bit of narrative as to the selections they would include on their mixtape, so to speak. So, you know, Harris used this opportunity with the Colbert segment to, you know, sort of share what her musical tastes were and then also kind of connect her listening preferences to her life experiences. You know, we see in this video, which you certainly can access through Colbert's YouTube channel, that, you know, with the style of the video, it's sort of this single close-up shot of her. She's speaking directly to the camera. She has a very warm and personable demeanor. At one moment, she sings a verse from a Bob Marley song called Sun is Shining. And, you know, I would argue that in this appearance, you know, her sort of warm demeanor, the not great singing, you know, I would argue that it's endearing, that it's she's making an effort to humanize herself in a way. You know, and this kind of extends to the song she chose to include on her mixtape. She does include Lady Gaga on there, but all the other artists represented on her list are Black. 4 out of the 11 are hip hop. You know, she's got artists such as Kendrick Lamar on there. Also, a Tribe Called Quest is on there. You know, these are, you know, they're both recognized as, you know, as a socially conscious artist. You know, she also has female performers on there. She includes Aretha Franklin, Beyonce, and as I said before, Lady Gaga. You know, these are all artists that are pretty, you know, openly feminist. So, you know, in a lot of ways, I would argue the mixtape kind of gives a sort of a musical voice to Harris as a progressive reformer. It shows her, you know, certainly aware with regards to issues surrounding race and gender diversity and the like. But, you know, folks on Twitter didn't really buy it. and across social media, you see these conversations emerging where they're critiquing Harris's performance in this video. And they're kind of calling her out for what they perceive as her lack of cultural knowledge. And, you know, for example, she does appear to say salt and pepper rather than salt and peppa. At one point, she gives a shout out to Fife Dog, who's a member of a tribe called Quest. And, you know, somebody pointed out the fact that Fife Dog was deceased. you know, others followed with memes in response to it that, you know, really kind of called into question her knowledge of sort of the culture she was trying to connect through in this mixtape. You know, others ask questions such as, well, okay, so Harris claims to love Bob Marley, but, you know, considering her policies as a prosecutor, wouldn't he have been put in jail, you know, because of, you know, his connection with marijuana, right? So, you know, really this video that I think she intended, you know, to be a way of humanizing herself. I think, you know, in the end, people used it as a platform for critiquing her policies as prosecutor. And they sort of pondered how, you know, this might shape her policymaking as a presidential candidate. So, you know, this case was particularly interesting to me because, you know, she used the mixtape and her assertion of musical taste really to, you know, establish herself as a Black candidate and connect with Black voters. And in a lot of ways, you know, her music strategy very much mirrored that of Obama in 2008. So
why was it, and not that Obama didn't have his critics of his music in 2008, he certainly did, but not to the extent that she did in 2020. So why might that be? And there's a couple of reasons, that I've come up with. One being, to a lot of folks on social media, they saw kind of a misalignment between, Harris's own personal history and her policy making and her identity as a progressive and the genre of hip hop. And I think while Obama tended to be more strategic and more tempered and more careful in the way he established his connection to hip hop, Harris really didn't approach it with that same level of cautiousness. Obama was adept enough in hip hop culture to suggest sort of his alignment with a pro-Black agenda. But, he also maintained enough distance from, some of the, perhaps more negative stereotypes and connotations connected to the genre and its artists. He also, as I mentioned earlier, underscored his generational distance by selecting music, that was R&B music that was popular in the 60s and the 70s. So, really Obama positioned himself as a role model, as a father figure, as an admirer, but not as an insider. Harris really offered no such distance. She embraces Fife Dog, Snoop Dogg, Too Short, and she kind of came across as being uninformed, and therefore she was seen as more of an interloper than a thoughtfully engaged fan. Kind of the second issue, as I see it, is, her professed love for gangster rap just really seemed out of sync with the more relatable sort of warm, communication style that she cultivated in videos like she did in the Mood Mix and elsewhere, really. But I think the bottom line here is, Harris is an intersectional candidate. I think the fact that she, was a woman sort of became complicated by her multiracial identity, and her multiracial identity was sort of complicated by the fact that, that she is a female candidate. And I think, this is what led to, her maybe being subjected to a level of criticism that Obama really was not.
Those are definitely some key different factors. And also interesting to think about kind of which of those are external. She would have had to face a different challenge anyway for gender, versus because of kind of how she communicated and how the differences there in terms of distancing or not. So thank you for taking us through those comparisons across the last few questions. I'd like to, in my next question, ask you not so much about a candidate, or I suppose not just about a candidate. You talk about in the book, one of the aspects of the 2020 Trump campaign that drew your attention was actually one of the artists involved. Can you tell us about what you think is significant about the sister act, Camille and Haley, in that campaign?
Sure. So Camille and Haley are a sister songwriting duo. They're from Oklahoma, and they became a talking point after an MSNBC reporter posted a clip of them singing one of their original songs called Keep America Great outside of the Box Center. This is in Tulsa, and it's where Trump held his, and again, quotes your first post-COVID rally, if you will. And this video that Cal Perry posted on social media received over 29 million views. So it was a really popular video. A lot of people were talking about it. And on the one hand, some people celebrated this video, and other people lampooned it and had a lot of really negative things to say. The duo also released a Keep America Great music video. So this was interesting to me because, in 2020 and really in 2016 as well, female artists really did not play a significant role in the official sort of Trump playlist, and really even homemade videos that you might find on YouTube or other video sharing platforms that were in support of Trump, most of them were created for men and by men. So Camille and Haley are kind of an outlier in that sense. And they're not the only ones, but there's certainly not as many female acts, you know, making videos in support of Trump. You know, the other reason it was of interest to me is, you know, Obama's candidacy in 2008 inspired so much thoughtful research. You know, a lot of it, you know, covers similar terrain as I do, and it looks at sort of the articulation of music and race on the trail. But there's really very little work that looks at how the categories of whiteness and femininity operate in campaign music. So, you know, I wanted to do some work on Camille and Haley because I thought it would be a good way to address this gap. So in terms of what's interesting about them, well, you know, in their pro-Trump videos, you know, they very much embrace the rhetoric of Christian nationalism, but in a very different way than the musical offerings of their male counterparts. You know, in a lot of ways, they're sort of putting forward this ideology, but they put it in a much more innocuous, much more pleasant type of packaging. You know, in their videos, you know, their family performs with them. You know, they show a lot of deference to male authority in their videos and in their presence on social media, whether it's deferring to their father or police figures or other forms of male authority. You know, they sing in a really, you know, a style that is very, very, very clear, very, they have very clear, very unadorned vocals as well. So they very much are embracing this sort of type of activism that is very much coded feminine in a way. But I kind of feel that's sort of the power in what they're doing is I think, you know, it's in terms of its messaging, it's, you know, in some ways kind of aligned with, you know, what we saw in the January 6th riots. But at the same time, it's packaged in a very sort of pleasant way, if you will. And this, you know, resulted in, you know, a lot of conversation of people kind of both defending them and people who were ready to take them down as well. On the one hand, you know, some posters praised how positive they were and the wholesomeness of their act and positioned it as, you know, kind of being antithetical to the ways in which the other side, the Democrats, sort of supported their point of view. And a lot of the posters online made reference to Black Lives Matter movement and to Antifa. So there was something about sort of the squeaky clean image of Camille and Haley, the civility that they represented that appealed to people on the right. But, you know, on the other hand, they did have their detractors, you know, people that were more left-leaning, pointed towards kind of the sort of propagandistic nature of their music online. And you know, some of them drew on you know, imagery of the Hitler Youth. They made references to North Korea. One poster even posted the scene from the film Cabaret where a member of the Hitler Youth sings a song called Tomorrow Belongs to Me. There were references to Jim Jones, David Koresh, this idea that, you know, it's kind of like this cultish sort of worship of Donald Trump. So they also had, there was also a lot of negative response as well. But I think, you know, to me, that's, you know, really what made the act to stand out and made it interesting. And, you know, another reason for exploring this is I think, you know, when conversations have circulated about women on the right participating in this way, you know, there's often this perception that they're, you know, kind of these mindless cogs of the patriarchy, if you will, and that they, you know, lack any kind of agency. And I didn't want to position Camille and Haley in that light. You know, my work mainly talks about their music, but, you know, these are actually women that have been very involved as activists for some time, and this, you know, their engagement with politics and activism certainly predates, predates their interest in Donald Trump. So it seemed like a good opportunity to, you know, rather than positioning them as sort of being passive in some way, to sort of think of them as agents and think of the role that, you know, women who, embrace these beliefs, to think about ways in which they choose to communicate, what are, you know, sort of the limitations of the way they communicate, and to think about what we could learn from them. And I think, you know, in the end, I think there's a lot of power in these types of acts because I think they're really able to speak across lines within the Republican Party. Although I think a lot of their ideas, may very well be fringe, I think their music is packaged in a way that it kind of masks the dangerous ideology within and really allows them to also speak to more conventional Republicans. So, for those reasons, I thought it was a really fascinating act to explore.
Yeah, no, lots of reasons to investigate. So thank you for giving us, obviously, in some ways, the summary version. The book has lots more detail, but giving us a sense of the importance there. Given that we're kind of up to, in many ways, sort of the current moment of American politics, what role do you think sound and music plays in this increased polarization that we're in now, especially around race?
It's a really good question. A lot of unofficial music on the campaign trail comes in the form of music videos. And by integrating image and sound, I think these media resonate on a very different level than text or image alone might. What we often see in these unofficial videos, you know, creators often cut and paste clips of news coverage and they repurpose or reinvent it, really to espouse their own narratives. So, you know, even very innocuous music media can convey a really distorted version of reality or communicate, a polarizing message. One example I'll give you, and this is sort of rewinding a bit, this is back in September 2020, then candidate Joe Biden made an appearance at the opening of Hispanic Heritage Month in Florida. And after he was introduced by Luis Fonsi, he took out his phone and he played the Spanish language chart topper Despacito, which you might be familiar with. And this moment went viral. Of course, some people were quick to criticize Biden for pandering to the Latin community. Trump actually tweeted an edited version of this incident a day later, but he replaced Despacito with NWA's, I don't know if I could say an expletive in here, Blank the Police is the song. Some praise Trump's troll game, while others believe Biden actually put NWA's track, that he actually walked out and played NWA's track. So, kind of the what I think this instance illustrates is, with social media, voters are really not passive consumers of a candidate's music. They're out there, they're creating and recreating music themselves, and they're participating in political conversation through music. So what kind of started is Biden's attempt to kind of, just give a shout out and a salute to Fonsi and his fans and to forge a connection, with the Latinx voters, was kind of transformed into this right-wing critique of the left's, purported position on law enforcement. So, as I see that, that's, really music, not only, sending a message that is polarizing in a way. It's also kind of a form of misinformation as well. And I think for the reasons I said before, I think sound, kind of operates on a different plane than word alone. And I think it's worth kind of understanding, how these instances of sort of music substitution and music information can shape discourses online, as clearly this instance did.
No, absolutely. I think that that example sort of exemplifies so many of the things we've been discussing and really adds to what we've already talked about that highlight kind of a lot of ways in which candidates are trying to balance between all these things and sort of, I think we've already mentioned a few sort of do's and don'ts, but I wonder if we can maybe make that a bit more explicit so that perhaps, I don't know, candidates listening, obviously I'm being mildly optimistic there, but if they were, if campaigns were listening, what could they learn from your book or what are some of the implications of it that could perhaps save them from being in this position of trying to put across a particular message and having audiences react very differently than they intend?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really good question. So, you know, I think candidates clearly for some time have used music to constitute their identity and sound, to, you know, sonically construct themselves in a way that appeals to the public and offers insight into their character and their beliefs. You know, coming at it from the perspective of you know, somebody who studies this, you know, in my opinion, an ideal campaign song or playlist, it needs to, on the one hand, authentically represent the candidate's history, their tastes, their values, their vision. But on the other hand, it also needs to speak to the tastes and the interests of the candidate's core constituency. And I think anytime you have sort of this really virulent strain of criticism, it sort of comes from a candidate sort of falling too far in one of these directions. So, you know, another example we might think of, you know, in 2016, Hillary Clinton created a Spotify playlist. She used, you know, tracks by artists like Kelly Clarkson, Demi Lovato, Katy Perry. And, you know, clearly she wanted to appeal to millennial female voters. You know, but while this might have been the music favored by her supporters, no one really believed Clinton listened to any of this music, right? So it fell flat, right? So, I mean, I think that's sort of the challenge that the people that are choosing music need to think about. You know, kind of take on the other hand, you know, Obama's 2008 campaign. I think, you know, he was successful in his use of music because people believed what he put on his playlist was really authentic to him. And he made a point of drawing out these things in interviews he did. He frequently talked about his tastes and his interests in music. So when people heard, you know, R&B of the 60s and 70s on the trail, it was believably his music, right? And it was believably the music of the people he was trying to attract to his campaign. So I think kind of following that rule. Now, that being said, you know, it's kind of easier said than done, right? In that, you know, people already have preconceived ideas as to what genres are associated with what audiences. You know, when people see a candidate, they probably already make their own assumptions about what that person might listen to. And if what they play is incongruous with people's perceptions, they're going to get criticized anyway. So I think it's, you know, obviously a delicate balance, but I think it's, you know, it's easy for me to sit back in the critic's chair and, you know, and talk about it. I think it's a lot harder to be the person sitting in that chair trying to pick the music. So I'm not sure I have any advice for people that try to do this. And thankfully, I'm on this side and not the other.
Well, given that you've just told us a whole bunch of things that candidates and campaigns want to think about when determining what music to choose and how to talk about it, is there anything going into the election season that voters or audience members might want to be thinking about or considering about the music that they're hearing from candidates?
Yes. You know, I think that it's important for, you know, the public to think critically about sound. I mean, I think, you know, most of us who have your standard K through 12 education, you know, I think we learn about the different ways, you know, words and images might be used to persuade us. But I think sound is often left out of the equation. And I think, you know, sometimes when I talk to people about this topic, you know, until I talk about it, they don't even really, it doesn't maybe even register that sound might be used to persuade them. So I think as a voter, I would want to be knowledgeable about how sound could play this role. And, you know, that gives me an opportunity to kind of introduce my other project here. So, you know, the book is something that's recent. It's 2023. But since 2015, I've been working on a website called Tracks on the Trail. That's tracks with an X rather than an S. And this is an open access website. It features essays, educational materials, podcasts, and through these materials, I work with a team of scholars, and we talk about all the different facets of music on the campaign trail. And we try to sort of turn a critical eye and a critical ear to these instances of music and really communicate with the public the different ways this music can function. So I think that would sort of be my piece of advice for anybody who's not only, looking at candidates, but listening to them as well, to, really take the time to educate oneself, on this topic. And our website is one platform through which people can do so.
That was preempting my next question very helpfully. Is there anything else that you're working on next that you'd like to preview or highlight?
So yes, I'll draw your attention to another aspect of the website. So the other thing we do is we track and catalog music that's heard on the campaign trail. So we look across social media, we go onto various news websites, and we look to see not only what candidates are playing when they walk on stage or appear at a fundraiser, but we're also looking at the types of music videos like Camille and Haley's Keep America Great that appear online. And we catalog those in our database, which has search functions that allow researchers or journalists or anyone else interested in this topic to really get a snapshot of what people are hearing on the campaign. And this is a great resource for people that, perhaps want to write a story about music on the trail, or people that just kind of want to get a sense as to what a candidate's music strategy is. So one of the things we'll be doing between now and Election Day is really listening closely to music on the ground and reporting on it in real time through our website. So that's kind of the big project at the moment.
Well, that will be very interesting, and I imagine rather a lot of work. So best of luck to you and the team for that. And of course, it sounds like listeners can follow along in a lot of senses on the website. And of course, by engaging with the book we've been discussing, titled Tracks on the Trail, Popular Music, Race, and the U.S. Presidency, published by the University of Michigan Press in 2023. Dana, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.